Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, a show where we speak to the top thought leaders in health policy, health innovation, and technology, and the great minds who are shaping the healthcare of the future. This week, Mark and Margaret speak with Gene Pinder, founder and CEO of Clear Health Costs, an organization dedicated to helping consumers understand what stuff costs in healthcare. It's a team of journalists and everyday citizens vetting and sharing their healthcare billing information around the country, a sort of mashup of Kayak and the Waze driving app to better inform the public about what's really behind health costs. Lori Robertson also checks in, the managing editor of FactCheck.org, looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain, separating the fake from the facts. And we end with a bright idea that's improving health and well-being in everyday lives. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. Or find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, or ask Alexa to play the program Conversations on Healthcare. Now, stay tuned for our interview with Gene Pinder, founder of Clear Health Costs, on Conversations on Healthcare.
We're speaking today with Gene Pinder, founder and CEO of Clear Health Cost, an award-winning web-based organization dedicated to promoting health industry price transparency to help consumers learn what stuff costs in healthcare. Prior to that, she served as an editor, reporter, and human service executive at the New York Times. Ms. Pinder was selected as a TED resident for the 2018 autumn cohort of Changemakers and was named a fellow of the Toe Center for Digital Journalism at Columbia University. She earned her degree in Slavic Studies from Indiana University and did advanced work at Leningrad State University in Russia. She also studied entrepreneurial journalism at CUNY Graduate School of Journalism. Gene, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, and now it's so exciting. You founded Clear Health Cost in 2011 after working at the New York Times. And you really wanted to achieve what seemed difficult to do, making it easier for consumers to understand what stuff cost in healthcare. And it seemed that your strategy was to use the power of journalism to create radical transparency in healthcare pricing by building this network of journalists committed to investigating the true health cost in their communities. And I wonder if you could tell our listeners more about the core mission at Clear Health Cost and how you attempted to shine a light on what's driving America's multi-trillion dollar healthcare system.
Yeah, so we were really early to the party on this. When we started out doing this, people laughed at us and said, you can't do it, it's too hard, nobody's going to care. When we started in 2011, remember, the Affordable Care Act was not yet in place. And so people told us, well, when the Affordable Care Act actually launches, everything is going to cost $20, and what you're doing is going to be completely irrelevant. Well, of course, as we've seen, nothing could be further from the truth. But when you think about the trajectory of what we've done over time, the number of people who are aware of this, involved in it, and harmed by it has grown exponentially. When we first started out, I would ask people if they were uninsured or knew somebody who was uninsured or had problems with a health bill, and you know, in a room, maybe half of the people would raise their hand. Now everybody raises their hand. So, you know, the growth of, I guess you would say the growth of high deductible plans, the growth of co-insurance, where people are responsible for 20% of payment after they meet their deductible, the just rampaging increases in prices, both for insurance products and also for the actual underlying health costs, everybody's affected by it. So power of journalism, both on our home site and in partnership with other newsrooms, we're telling people what things cost in healthcare. Most people don't realize that the same blood test could cost $19 one place or $520 another. The same MRI could be $475 one place or $6,221 just a few miles away. And you don't know until months later you get an explanation of benefits that explains exactly nothing. So because of the high cost, this has generated a huge, slow-rolling public health crisis where people feel they can't afford treatment, so they don't get it. We hear this over and over and over again. People get sicker. They die for lack of treatment. Mm-hmm. Recent headlines have spotlighted people who can't afford insulin, but there are hundreds and thousands of people facing these choices every day.
So, Gina, Clear Health Costs has developed an online tool called Price Check, which you've described, and I love this description, as a mashup of Kayak.com and the Waze traffic app for healthcare. Waze changed my life, by the way, so very great that you've included that. And it aggregates crowdsourced health pricing data from actual health consumers, which is then verified and supplemented by journalists who are doing their own price checking. So talk about how media and other partners contribute to Clear Health Cost pricing framework, and just how does the whole health reporting system work?
Yeah, so we built interactive software that very much resembles what we use on our own site, and then we place it on our partners' websites. Makes it easy for people to both contribute their prices and to search a database. The database is powered by our initial reporting. As journalists, we call hospitals, doctors, clinics, and ask them for their cash prices for common shoppable procedures. So there are 30 or 35 things that people can actually have discretion over. And then we make it really easy for people to contribute doing what we call crowdsourcing, because insurers do not want to tell us what their negotiated rates are, and because we know that people have a lot of information about pricing that surpasses our cash knowledge in their filing cabinets, their Google wallets, their credit card statements. So we ask people to join hands with us and do this kind of journalism. We also do data journalism and investigative journalism to help reveal the secrets of healthcare pricing.
Well, speaking of journalism and journalists, we've had a couple of guests on our show, including your former New York Times colleague and author Elizabeth Rosenthal, as well as Stephen Brill, who both educated and I think illuminated our listeners on how hospital charge masters function, those behind the scene entities that set hospital prices in secret. And surprisingly, the Trump administration recently ordered the industry's compliance with the little-known provision of the Affordable Care Act requiring hospitals to make those charge master prices available to the public. And I'm wondering if you could help us understand why this approach to transparency, though perhaps well-intentioned, is inadequate, and there also might be a better approach out there.
Yeah, so the charge masters, as you mentioned, are the sticker price or list price only. They're reflected in the sort of medical gobbledygook that is very hard for people to understand. It doesn't use the standard medical coding system, only a very few of the ones that I've seen. So you can't really compare from place to place. And plus, the list price is generally really high. So if you could actually decode it as a patient, consumer, or as we like to call them, people, you might find out that the price is unacceptably high and choose not to have that procedure. So what would be a better solution? Use the coding system uniformly across all spreadsheets and to require hospitals, doctors, clinics, ambulatory surgical centers, all the providers, to reveal not just the sticker price, but also what Medicare actually pays, mm-hmm. which is a good fixed or benchmark price mm-hmm. in the marketplace. Mm-hmm. Also, the cash rate for that procedure. Hmm. We've heard a lot of people getting a lower cash price than they get on for their insurance. Hmm. And also, we'd like to see the negotiated rates for the major insurers for each provider and each procedure. That would be Blue Cross, United Healthcare, Cigna, Aetna, and any other mm-hmm. major provider. That would be true transparency.
Hmm. Well, Gene, I think people can probably surmise that trying to price what a hospital admission would be with all that goes on and all the variability and some of the unpredictability would be a real challenge for most consumers in advance. But you say that they have a much better shot at realizing cost savings when it comes to things like diagnostic tests or prescription drugs, where prices vary widely, but it's kind of it's an N of one that you're trying to get information on. You know, we've been very aware over these last couple of years that most Americans are uninsured for part of the year these days. If they have commercial insurance, they have very high deductibles that they have to meet for all but the essential benefits that were prescribed under Obamacare. And so it's really in all American consumers' best interest to shop around a bit, perhaps before getting an MRI or filling a prescription. talk with us about this huge variation in pricing and why sometimes it may be even cheaper to just pay cash, as you were just alluding to a few moments ago.
Right. Well, start out by telling a story about a woman in New Orleans who saved $3,786 by shopping around. She was prescribed an MRI by her GP for a common hereditary problem that she has, a hereditary problem. And she scheduled the MRI. The hospital called her 2 days before and said, how are you going to pay for this? And she said, well, how much is it going to cost? And they said, well, what's your deductible? And she said, $5,000, but what does that matter? They said, we'll call your insurance company and call you back. So they called her back and said, well, the good news is you've spent part of your deductible, so that MRI is only going to cost you $4,538.
Oh, my God.
She said, what? So she happens to work, actually, at the Times-Picayune, which is one of our news partners there. She went over and talked to our reporter and said, is this possible? Can this be real? And he said, well, look in the database and see if you can find the procedure. Find the number, the medical coding number. See if you can find the procedure and tell me what you see. So she came back and said, I must be doing something wrong. I found it for $672.86. And he said, I'm not sure you're doing anything wrong. We see variations like that all the time. So she said, what should I do? He said, check your work, call your doc, and if everything looks right, you should, you know, go ahead and have it at the less expensive place, which she did, saving $3,786. And, you know, telling us, by the way, that she'd actually pretty much decided that she wasn't going to have the procedure because it was so expensive. Incidentally, the less expensive one was also an in-network provider, so it did fall against her deductible. She didn't pay cash. Nobody's taking care of her except for us. We're the people who are helping her, which is a really interesting thing if you think about it. We're journalists. We're not really healthcare people. Somebody in healthcare might be thinking about helping her. The other point that you made, actually, we have heard a lot of people saying that instead of paying the negotiated rate, they found that if they ask for a cash price, they'll pay less, sometimes startlingly less, hundreds, even thousands of dollars less. So it really is important for people to ask in every case.
We're speaking today with Jean Pinder, founder and CEO of Clear Health Cost, an award-winning web-based organization dedicated to promoting healthcare price transparency through media and other industry partners to better inform consumers on what stuff costs in healthcare. Prior to that, she served as an editor, reporter, and human service executive at the New York Times. Jean, American consumers have become so savvy at shopping online for pretty much everything they consume except healthcare. And your tools provide this opportunity to really change that. I'm wondering what you think the cultural bias is out there around why people are shopping online and making price decisions everywhere but healthcare. And I know you're trying to change that, and I think people will behave in that. But have you uncovered anything about the cultural context that has led us to somehow, you know, be blinded on anything around cost that relates to healthcare?
You know, that's a great question. We think, first off, that most people, when they enter the healthcare marketplace, do not expect to be ripped off or to have their pockets picked. They expect that prices are going to be somehow uniform or regulated, that their insurance policy and their provider, be it a hospital or a doctor, are taking care of them and not seeking to just collect a whole bunch of money. So people really have this expectation that good things are going to happen in healthcare. That's starting to change because with so many high deductible plans, high co-insurances, doctors and hospitals out of network, so many more people are exposed to these random pricing variations and the gotcha bills, really punishing bills that come along with not asking the question. I also think there's a little bit of a stigma or a taboo that maybe a patient doesn't want to ask her doctor because the doctor either won't know, or maybe the doctor feels that he or she is being somehow unfairly impugned as a money grubber. It's just a very complicated conversation, mm-hmm. I think, mm-hmm. for patients and doctors to have. Mm-hmm. What we try to do is to make it easier for that conversation to happen. So that if you're in your doctor's office and she sends you for an MRI, you can pull out your handheld and say, you know what, you just sent me to a place that has a $6,221 MRI. I have a high deductible plan. Is it okay if I go to the place that has the $600 MRI? So that you can have a better conversation between patients and providers about things like that.
Well, you know, Gene, we often lay the onus on the government to fix things or for industry to fix things by perhaps not raking in quite so much profit on the back of consumers. But in this scenario, I don't think we're holding out too much hope for that, although it did seem like a step that the administration was requiring the publishing of the charge master. But for those of us on the front lines of care delivery, as well as involved in the process of training and educating the next generation of the healthcare workforce, what are your thoughts on how we can help clinicians learn to play perhaps a more active role in bringing down health costs or in just supporting their patients and making good decisions about what their recommended treatments are from a purchasing and cost perspective? Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, so we have our handy 10 questions to ask for patients to use when they're inquiring of providers. We think that everybody should get in the habit of asking those questions every time and that it will become easier. It might be a little bit uncomfortable at the very beginning, but it has to happen. And we hear a lot from clinicians who are beginning to take a more active role, as they are already, realizing that money is a problem in treatment. We hear all the time clinicians saying, why didn't you take that prescription? Why didn't you get that treatment? Why did you wind up in the emergency room? When the patient or consumer or the person, again, has decided that it's too hard to talk about money with the doc. They realize that the prescription that was $40 last month is $500 this month, and they're going to have to choose between medicine or food. It happens over and over and over again. Docs and hospitals need to make it easy for people to ask these questions and to have these conversations. And we hope to facilitate that with our data.
Gene, you likened to where we are now in healthcare to the former oppressive struggle, stronghold of the Soviet Union. You were there when the wall came down, due in large part to public pressure. And you say that the American healthcare system stands at a similar moment. And that it won't be the government, but empowered and informed health consumers that will help tear down that wall. And I'm wondering how you see that plays out. And also, do you see that these new tech-enabled players like Amazon, Apple, and Google will help advance that in any way? So walk us through how you see this future of the dissembling of the iron grip that the healthcare industry has on pricing and people's behavior will change.
Yes. I do believe that patients or consumers or people are so angry and afraid about this that they are at the breaking point. Employers also. And that this may unlock the sort of logjam that we see in the legislative and regulatory function. Our system is damaging the nation's health. It's weakening businesses and school districts and governments. Money goes pouring out of our pockets and our budgets and into this seemingly unfillable pit of health costs. So people get it. People understand now more and more. And I do think they're about to march on the healthcare system and on their legislators and regulators with pitchforks and torches because they're so angry and so upset. You ask, and conceivably, that will result in some kind of legislative or regulatory action. I don't say that with a great deal of hope in the near future, but right now, change has to come from somewhere. You ask about Amazon, Apple, and Google. I'd like to think that the salvation is going to come from there, but truly, when you get right down to it, they're here to make money. What we need is fewer people and entities who are here to make money and more people who want to solve the problem.
So people just come to a website, is that right?
Yeah.
And tell us a little more about how that works.
Yeah, so we have our home website, which has the interactive software on it. It has the search tool. We also do a blog explaining to people things like those 10 questions to ask about how to mm-hmm. find out what stuff costs in healthcare. And we use the blog also to explain, hey, maybe you will get off better by paying cash. Or, hey, here's how this guy saved $2,000 by arguing a bill. So that we're sort of crowdsourcing the news on this topic as we go forward. And then we have the partnerships with news organizations nationwide where we do a larger version of that, a deep dive in New Orleans, Philadelphia, San Francisco, Los Angeles. Spend less time on medications because there are other tools out there. People with very deep pockets like GoodRx.com and Blink Health that are online sources of pricing information. We do have a lot of pricing information on drugs, but because somebody else is doing that, we spend more time on procedures. I will say about medications the same thing that we say about procedures. You should always ask. Ask every time, how much is this going to cost me on my insurance plan? What's the cash price? Because quite often we've learned that people can actually get a much better price by putting away their insurance card and paying cash. And you should tell everybody you know that they need to ask what's the cash price on that every time, every single time.
So I'm a journalist. I'm listening to this radio show. What do I do? How my news organization may not be engaged. Do I reach out to you? What's the best pathway?
Please. I'm Jeannie@clearhealthcosts.com. We're expanding all the time. We're looking for partners, and we're really happy to talk to like-minded people.
We've been speaking today with Jean Pinder, founder and CEO of Clear Health Costs, an award-winning web-based organization that's dedicated to promoting healthcare price transparency. You can learn more about their important work and do your own comparison shopping by going to clearhealthcosts.com or follow them on Twitter @CHCosts. Jean, we want to thank you for your groundbreaking work, your dedication to improving healthcare and access to it, and for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Thank you so much for having me.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
New York Governor Andrew Cuomo signed the Reproductive Health Act on January 22nd, the anniversary of the landmark Roe v. Wade Supreme Court decision that guaranteed a woman's right to an abortion. Readers have sent us a number of questions about the law, particularly what it means for late-term abortions. Let's look at the facts. The state law permits abortions prior to 24 weeks of the commencement of pregnancy. After 24 weeks, there are restrictions. Previously, under the old law, pregnancies after that time could be terminated only if they were life-threatening. The new law provides for two more instances in which abortions would be allowed, the, quote, absence of fetal viability, or to protect the patient's health. A licensed healthcare practitioner must make the determination that those factors exist. Roe v. Wade held that states may limit abortions after fetal viability, except in cases, quote, necessary to preserve the life or health of the mother. So New York's old law was inconsistent with part of the Roe decision. As for what constitutes fetal viability, the Roe decision defined it as the point when a fetus was, quote, potentially able to live outside the mother's womb, albeit with artificial aid. Under the old New York state law, abortions not permitted under the statute were criminalized, but the new law removed abortion from the penal code. The homicide statute, however, defines a person as, quote, a human being who has been born and is alive. Killing a baby once born was and is still considered a homicide. Proponents of the bill argued that abortion should be treated as a health care matter, not as a criminal one. As for late-term abortions, states define that in different ways. Some states ban abortions after 20 weeks. How often are such abortions performed? The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says about 1% of abortions were done after 21 weeks, according to 2015 data. 65% were performed within the first 8 weeks of pregnancy. The CDC also said that between 2006 and 2015, less than 9% of abortions were performed after 13 weeks. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Students of public health are often tasked with devising interventions for addressing some of health's biggest challenges. And for Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health students Dan Wexler and Priya Patel, their idea netted an award and launched a business idea at the same time. The students were tasked with addressing food insecurity in underserved parts of the world, including in neighborhoods in their own backyard. Families living in high poverty, low resource area, and finding fresh, affordable, healthy food in neighborhoods with no grocery stores or food markets. They thought of the current trend of healthy mail order meals services like Blue Apron and wondered, what if we modified that business model to serve the needs of those living in food deserts? Wexler and his partner sourced food delivery companies that could provide prepackaged meal kits with all ingredients included, even spices, dressings, and recipes. And instead of home delivery approach, they designed refrigerated kiosks that could easily be placed in local neighborhoods. Wexler says they wanted to make the idea of healthy eating and meal preparation as simple as possible.
I think the biggest change is that there is no delivery system door-to-door per se, and that by going and setting up these kiosks in the community, you can have a very lean design. You don't need a storefront. You don't need to pay for shipping. You don't need to have in-box refrigeration. And you are very much addressing the need of access by physically saying, hey, here is healthy food. It's convenient because everything you need is in the box. The directions are simple and very picture-based. There's a lot of literacy issues. And so just really thinking about how can we take all those lean design principles to facilitate access that really, I think, make it a solution that has the potential for impact.
And they also conducted research with local ethnic groups to create recipes that would resonate with their families.
And we just went down to the community and did taste testing at the farmers market and talked to people and said, you know, do you like this? What do you want to be able to eat for dinner? How do you want to cook? So basically, we have some dishes that are similar textures, similar spices. One thing that we found is there's a little bit of contention between parents who want to eat more traditional foods and kids who want to eat more American foods, and we try to alleviate that and bridge those gaps. So one of our recipes, for instance, is a chicken pot pie pasta. So it's kind of American, it's fun sounding, but also we use a lot of traditional seasonings and spices.
Customers can simply walk to the kiosk and purchase their meal kits with the SNAP cards or cash. And they added benefits. The kiosk will be run by the residents of the neighborhood, giving them an opportunity to purchase the kiosk and run them like a franchise, offering an economic benefit to the community as well. Their idea earned them the Rabobank MIT Food and Agribusiness Innovation Prize and $15,000 in startup money to launch their enterprise, a low-cost, portable, healthy meal service placed in portable kiosks in food desert neighborhoods, offering families a simple solution to address the problem of poor nutrition, providing an economic opportunity at the same time. Now that's a bright idea. You've been listening to Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare is recorded at WESU, at Wesleyan University, streaming live at chcradio.com, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. The show is brought to you by the Community Health Center.